And then he had no more to tell her. And then he told her. He had told her that it was as before, that he still loved her, that he would never stop loving her, that he would love her until his death.
Previews of coming attractions.
Welcome back to Sunday Night in Cinema 3. New in theaters this week is Gringo, starring David Oyelowo, Charlize Theron, Amanda Seyfried, and Joel Edgerton, in a film directed by his brother, Nash Edgerton. It seems to be an action comedy where Oyelowo travels to Mexico on business for his pharmaceutical company, and hijinks ensue. I think I'll give this one a pass on the big screen. Also opening this week is The Hurricane Heist. It's kind of like a cross between Twister and Ocean's 11, and again, I think I'll pass. A third opening in theaters this week is the so-called horror film The Strangers, Pray at Night, an unwanted sequel to an also unwanted original, which I watched 10 years ago in Cinema 3. I'm a bit torn on this one, actually. I feel like I should go see it, if only to give me more to say about the original when I have to do an episode about it later this year, but we'll see. And finally, the last big opener this week is Disney's new version of A Wrinkle in Time, starring no less than Oprah Winfrey. I have mixed feelings about it, which I won't go into now, but they add up to a no for me on seeing it on the big screen. Perhaps I'll catch it on a streaming service one day. As for home video, two big releases this week that are at the opposite ends of the budget and promotion spectrum: Thor Ragnarok, directed by Taika Waititi, and Lady Bird, written and directed by Greta Gerwig. Both of them are great films, but if I'm honest, I'm probably only going to buy the Thor film on Blu-ray. I can envision myself rewatching it for years to come. Also new on DVD this week, but probably not destined for my DVD collection: The Man Who Invented Christmas, starring Christopher Plummer; Wonder Wheel, starring Kate Winslet; a documentary called Faces Places, featuring some key figures of the French New Wave; and the Oscar-nominated animated adaptation of The Breadwinner. If your budget allows for it, the obvious choice for movies to own this week, I think, is Thor Ragnarok.
Previously on Sunday Night in Cinema 3.
10 years ago, I had the pleasure, if you can call it that, of watching a film called Jumper in Cinema 3. It starred Hayden Christensen, a.k.a. Angry Face McGee from the Star Wars prequel trilogy, plus his future wife Rachel Bilson from The O.C., and Samuel L. Jackson from Everything Else. Christensen discovers as a bully teenager that he has the ability to teleport, and he uses it to escape his abusive father, played by Michael Rooker. He spends some time learning his new powers, and then leverages them to steal a bunch of money from some banks and set himself up in some nice apartments. Samuel Jackson plays a paladin, a member of a secret organization that goes around killing jumpers, because jumpers historically become evil and abuse their powers. Hayden just wants to be left alone to enjoy his ill-gotten gains, but Jackson comes for him with a kind of electric rod weapon, and Hayden is forced to jump blindly back to his hometown, where he reconnects with his childhood sweetheart, played by Bilson. He knows that she's always wanted to travel, so he uses some of his resources to escort her to Rome, with Jackson and the paladins in pursuit. This film is actually better than I remembered in some ways, and the supporting cast is impressive. Jamie Bell, Diane Lane, Teddy Dunn from Veronica Mars, Tom Hulce from Amadeus, and even a quick scene with Kristen Stewart. The effects hold up pretty well, and the stunt and fight choreography is pretty good, too. They came up with some inventive ways to show us what it might be like to fight someone who can teleport. But the film is also worse in a lot of ways than I remembered, because for all of the talent involved, this action film about people who can teleport is surprisingly dull and directionless. Hayden's lack of charisma serves the film well at first, when he's being an emotionally broken jerk living like the 1%. But it becomes a problem when he has to interact with Jamie Bell or even Bilson. The film begins and ends with the optimistic attitude that will follow him on many more adventures, but it seems that one jump was enough back then, and it's still enough now.
Intermission.
Last week, while I was Oscar bashing, I mentioned how the internet and the rise of cable has given us unprecedented access to news and pseudo-news about movie-making and cinema history. I don't mean to say that this can be an entirely bad thing. If I had cable, it would be tuned to Turner Classic Movies at least 90% of the time. But there are definitely downsides to this omnipresent access. And to me, one of the biggest is that some movie fans go around acting as if they're investors in film studios and cinema chains. They make predictions about box office numbers, they talk about Rotten Tomatoes or IMDb user ratings, as if any of that actually matters to them or anyone else. I'm not sure that stuff should even matter to Hollywood, but I suppose we can't help ourselves. We are told to find celebrities fascinating, and reality television pretends to give us a glimpse behind the scenes of their lives, so we start to feel invested. Even actual hard news outlets can't resist the allure and the ratings bump of entertainment reporting. In one of the early episodes of the podcast, I talked about the difference between a movie review and film criticism. A quick recap if you didn't hear it or don't remember. I made a distinction between a movie review, which is essentially a gut check about how we feel about a film, and whether we would recommend it to someone else. I compared it to the simple thumbs up or thumbs down of the late Siskel and Ebert's television series. Film criticism, on the other hand, is more academic and dispassionate. It attempts to place a film in the larger context of the history of cinema, and it may be revised over time because, of course, a film can lose or gain relevance as a society evolves. The point I want to make this week is that we shouldn't give a lot of value to something like Rotten Tomatoes, and I say this as someone who is listed as a reviewer on Rotten Tomatoes, which is another completely uninteresting story that I will not bother to tell you now. Rotten Tomatoes is an aggregator of film reviews. They literally track the professional and top amateur film critics' gut check reviews of new films, and also invite users to post their own ratings. This can be useful information for deciding whether or not you want to spend the money and time on going to the cinema. But that's not the same as film criticism. It is essentially consumer advice. News you can use, as they used to say. There are, of course, countless examples of films that were critically lambasted and hated by the public during their original release, most famously Orson Welles' Citizen Kane, which didn't gain critical traction until a decade after its release and is now generally considered to be one of the best films ever made. Of course, Kane had the added disadvantage of being opposed by a powerful news organization owned by a powerful man upon which the film was based, but it's not as if that kind of media campaign against a film couldn't happen today. It absolutely could. But I think what tends to happen more often today is the opposite, where a film is overpraised by an industry that has an interest, financial or otherwise, in a 3-star film being rounded up to 4. This can result in Best Picture awards that we feel embarrassed about some years later, like the white savior film Dances with Wolves, which won over Goodfellas of all things, or preachy fake liberal guilt films like Crash. It's not that those films are awful, they were just overpraised at the time, and once the heat of awards season wore off, they got rounded back down in the longer-term memory of film criticism. I think we're going to be doing that again when we talk about the 2018 Oscars. I am a big fan of the original Creature from the Black Lagoon and of Guillermo del Toro. I'm glad he got to make his crazy Amelie Fucks a Fishman movie, and I don't mean to be some kind of genre snob. I'm happy that a film like The Shape of Water could get nominated over boring historical dramas or inspirational biographies. I'd be even happier if an animated film, a comedy, or even a musical could get a Best Picture award these days, but that's another story. Del Toro absolutely does deserve to be an Oscar winner for something, so it may as well be The Shape of Water. But personally, when I think of the great films of 2017 and the years to come, I suspect I'll be thinking more about Call Me By Your Name, Get Out, Baby Driver, The Big Sick, and Blade Runner 2049, all of which did at least get some nominations and most of which did get an award or two. I was especially glad to see both Blade Runner 2049 and Roger Deakins win awards. Deakins is a master cinematographer who is overdue for a statue, and Blade Runner 2049 has been underrated. I think that its legend will grow, and it will be recognized as a classic just as the original did. What saddens me is that for all of the activity around promoting and reviewing and selling movies, the general public doesn't ever seem to get much smarter about cinema, and Hollywood certainly doesn't seem to either. They still want to project the image of wealthy white people who care about those who are disadvantaged from their perspective, by not being white or male or neurotypical. Hollywood even cares about a whimsical mute woman who wants to fuck a fish man. Hollywood may have the sense to not automatically award movies about white saviors anymore, but unfortunately, Hollywood is itself the biggest white savior of all. And as long as it is that, we're going to have this kind of disconnect between what they call the best picture of the year and what film critics canonize and film lovers remember fondly after some time has passed.
And now, our feature presentation.
This week's DVD from my collection is called The Lover, a 1992 French film directed by Jean-Jacques Annaud, based on the autobiographical novel of the same name by Marguerite Duras. It's the story of how Duras, as a teenage girl in Saigon during its French colonial period, seduced a wealthy Chinese man twice her age. Even by French film standards, this one is pretty explicit and very sexy in several senses of the word. It stars model and actress Jane March, who herself had just turned 18 when this film was made, as the young girl, and legendary Chinese actor Tony Leung Ka Fai as her lover. The two meet on a ferry crossing the Mekong River to Saigon. She's returning to her convent school after a break, glad to be getting away from a home where her older brother is abusive and her mother is indifferent. Her father is dead, and a younger brother is fragile. So from an almost stereotypical psychology, Duras implies that her young self seeks out the Chinese man to feel safe and in control. She lies to him on their first meeting, telling him that she is 17, rather than 15 and a half, and she goes on to insist that she could never love him, so he doesn't ever need to worry about some sort of awkward situation coming up. He also expresses concerns that he could fall in love with her. Needless to say, watching this scenario play out in a film is uncomfortable for people. No one likes to think about teenagers having sex with adults, no matter how well-adjusted and willing the teenager appears to be, and no matter what the social expectations were of the time. So if the idea of watching such a thing bothers you, I understand. It may comfort you to know that the relationship does not work out in the long run, but then, of course, most relationships don't. The great French actress Jeanne Moreau provides Duras' voice as the narrator of the film, looking back upon it as an adult in a tone that sometimes feels fond and sometimes feels regretful. And in that regard, it reminds me a great deal of Call Me By Your Name. I think the real value of the film is also the one that allows me to disregard the ick factor that you might feel about the relationship. The fact that it is someone's actual life story, albeit through a thin veneer of fiction. Duras did have this affair when she was a girl, and it was a scandal at the time, though not so much for the age difference of the lovers as for the difference in their races. That is the element that sets this apart from most coming-of-age films. It belongs in the same tradition as Bonjour Tristesse, Stealing Beauty, and La Belle Personne. So I do recommend The Lover. It's beautifully shot, and the performances are great. It feels like a real time capsule of an era that was long past even when the film was made, and is nearly a century ago as I record this. The moment near the beginning where Jane March kisses the car window while Tony Leung watches is one of the most memorable moments in the history of cinema. It's worth checking out for that moment alone. Just don't say I didn't warn you.
Roll the credits.
Sunday Night in Cinema 3 is produced, written, and recorded by Scott Marshall, that's me, with much appreciated help from Nicole Slip and the nice people at the Central Branch of the Halifax Public Library. Sunday Night in Cinema 3 is copyright 2018 by Scott Marshall, all rights reserved. Please send your feedback, questions, or concerns to Sunday Night in Cinema 3, that's the number 3, not the written out word 3, at gmail.com or through social media. Visit SundayNightInCinema3.com for our links to Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, and whatever other social media platforms I can stand to deal with. This podcast does not have any advertisements because I figure we all have enough advertising in our lives, but it does have some modest expenses. So if you'd like to support the podcast, you can check out my Patreon at patreon.com/ScottMarshall. That's 2 T's, 2 L's. For as low as $1 a month, you will have exclusive benefits, including outtakes and bonus material from the podcast, a heads up on what's coming up from me, and access to other exclusive digital content that I haven't even thought of yet. The Patreon also has a community forum where you can talk to each other or ask me questions, and if you subscribe for $5 a month or more, you will receive regular packages of physical stuff from me in the mail, including comics, art prints, stickers, game prototypes, and whatever else I can think of to send. Whatever you do, thank you very much for listening, and I hope you enjoyed it. See you next Sunday in Cinema 3.
Good night.